Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. This week our focus looks at the unfurling political unrest between Australia and our biggest trading partner, China. With the recent oustings of Donald Trump, it could be said that global tensions in respect to China have had the potential to ease somewhat, with a typically more conciliatory Democrat government in the US coming in to temper what has been a rollicking few years under the previous administration. In the face of this, however, and on home soil, the temperature is now rising on Australian-China relationships, with both parties delivering volleys of fire. Early this month, news came out that China had ordered traders to stop purchasing at least seven categories of Australian commodities, including coal, barley, copper ore and concentrate, sugar, timber, wine and lobster, ratcheting up tensions with its key trading partner, us, in the most sweeping retaliation yet. And now, on Tuesday this week, Australia has signed off on a landmark defence deal with Japan, taking the next step towards building a coalition of like-minded democracies, pushing back against what they view as Beijing's increasing expansionism in the Indo-Pacific. And just when we thought that the year 2020 had enough on its plate. Here to dive in the detail of the next chapter of Australian-China relations and how these themes can be used in our portfolios, I'm joined by Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello to you, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
And we also have on the line our Chief Strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith. Hello to you, David.
G'day, Tim.
Good to have you on. And just a quick reminder that before we get started, to subscribe on YouTube and click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. And also, we do ask if you could take a moment to click like on the video now to help our show grow. And also, for those listening in live, feel free to drop in your questions in the YouTube live stream chat to have them answered along the way. So let's jump into the agenda for today. So we're going to kick off with a little bit of background and then have a look into China decoupling from Australia, and then, of course, wrapping all of this up, as we do in every show, in the investment outlook and how we use these themes every day here at Nucleus Wealth. So to kick us off, background, gents, where would you like to get started?
Well, I'd like to offer some of my own background before we kick off.
Sure.
Around 2001, I was the founding publisher of a magazine called The Diplomat, and it was, basically an Australian version of The Economist or Foreign Affairs or Foreign Policy, all these kind of international relations organs that track the relationships between countries in economic and geopolitical terms, and that thing has now grown into the largest portal of its kind in Asia. In fact, really, it's the only one at all. It's run out of Japan these days. So I just wanted to get that on the record because I've been intimately involved in geopolitics for 20 years and more. And just so that viewers can understand that I've got a bit of pedigree in this space, which is something that the broader media basically ignores when it comes to interviewing me on these subjects. So that out of the way. Some context. All right, well, so starting from 2003-ish, just after China entered the WTO, it developed into this giant economic juggernaut that was sucking in commodities like there was no tomorrow, and this proved to be an incredible boom for Australia in terms of trade boom. And ever since then, Australian policymakers have basically looked the other way on anything that more traditional Australian regimes might have found distasteful about China, things like Tibet, for instance. Pre-2003, the Dalai Lama used to visit Australia regularly and had a big lefty following. He suddenly became quite unwelcome. And that trended along almost ceaselessly with Australia selling out democratic values and what have you for almost nonstop until 2010 or 11, right through the GFC, when obviously, Chinese demand for our commodities helped us get through that. Probably over-egged, but certainly helped. And you know, Australia, again, just continued nonstop to look the other way over all sorts of issues, as did many others, most countries, in fact, as they just took the Chinese money and ran. You know, these issues included, obviously, but huge intellectual property theft and stealing of technology, you know, these kind of like huge trade issues, as well as the ongoing tensions over human rights and what have you. But those were very secondary to the trade issues in the end. And that all culminated in signing an FTA under the coalition government in, 2016, 17?
Free trade agreement for anyone who's not
a free trade agreement. And you know, at that juncture, we'd been integrating with China economically for nearly 20 years and politically kind of shaving off all of the sharp edges that might have gotten in the way of the relationship, you know, nonstop for 15, on the basis, you know, the excuse was that China will liberalise, that liberalising its economy will lead to liberalising its politics. And so the best way to bring China into the global fold of both economic opening and political opening was to engage with it. You know, this was the thesis. Well, at The Diplomat, we interviewed Peter Costello in 2007 and asked him straight, as he was sort of aiming to become prime minister, why he didn't, you know, the coalition government of the time had dropped all and any of its objections to China's more unsavory behaviours, and he just said outright, it will liberalise. That was the excuse or the reasoning. Now, of course, you know, around 2011, 2012, Xi Jinping took control of the Chinese Communist Party, and that liberalisation process went into complete reverse. Xi Jinping being a much more traditional Chinese Communist Party apparatchik, proceeded to, you know, to launch various political pogroms, anti-corruption drives, not all of them bad, in fact, and, you know, some liberalisation programs that were also quite constructive, but politically it was all very retrograde, and a lot of it was twisted around, you know, his own objectives of essentially turning himself into dictator for life of China.
And I think the main complaint as well, David, over that time was that the anti-corruption was obviously a noble cause, but it seemed to pick up a remarkable number of his political enemies and be relatively friendly to his political friends.
Exactly right. So, and that internal turn and towards, you know, greater hawkishness was accompanied by an external turn to greater hawkishness as well. And this is where, you know, we might discuss later through this podcast something called Xi Jinping thought, which is becoming increasingly important, which is kind of the modern CCP manifesto, which is basically CCP national security all the time, in everything all the time, is what it boils down to. So that started to create a much more hostile and hawkish outlook as well in China. And we've seen that in, you know, build-outs of what are effectively stationary aircraft garrigas throughout the South China Sea for nearly a decade now, as China sort of randomly drew this thing called the 9-dash line, which is right across or surrounding the entire South China Sea, and said everything inside that is ours, and the rest of you can all bugger off. And that included a whole bunch of different countries whose sovereign territory just simply got claimed by Beijing. You know, everyone from Vietnam to Philippines and then Southeast Asians as well. And so that's kind of the general backdrop to what happened over the last 20 years between China and Australia. Obviously a very potted history, but that's more or less it. And then that hawkishness that I've described coming out of Beijing in Australian terms turned quite toxic somewhere in the kind of 2010s. Hard to pinpoint exactly when, but at a certain point, you know, probably around 2014-15, especially when Chinese immigration really took off and a lot of money started to pour into the Australian property sector, etc. Money also started to pour into Australian politics, dodgy CCP-backed money. And It's all very vague. It's difficult to pinpoint. It's hard to find the smoking gun, but it is there. It's very prevalent. And it, you know, around 2016, it started to catch people out. So that's when we started to see things like Sam Dastyari get sprung, taking the cash, you know, in return for spruiking Chinese interests. And from there on, we just saw, you know, it kind of, that was the kind of pivotal moment from which the media became alerted to what was going on.
Well, and the Darwin Port, Darwin Ports as well, David. That was probably a bit of a
Yes, Darwin Ports. I mean,
maybe not in the media, but certainly I think from the US and probably the the spy sort of.
Yeah. Yes, I think Darwin Ports, which was a bit earlier, alarmed the security agencies a lot more than it did the press. So the press was just a kind of Andrew Robb quirk. Or hypocrisy.
And do you want to just give a quick background to that, David, just for people who hadn't
Sure. Well, I mean, it's basically Australia's trade minister of the time walked out of his job and into a job with a Chinese consulting with a Chinese conglomerate who leased the Darwin port for 99 years. Right
from
next
him.
from him, and yeah. You know, for which he was handsomely paid, you know, it was right next door to the Marines base, and you know, it was like, well, this is all a bit preposterous, isn't it? In effect, you know, the Chinese were then subletting to the US Marines, and you know, the whole thing was like completely ill-conceived, and it just, if you could find a single infrastructure asset at which Australia's strategic and economic interests came clashing together, it was in the Darwin port. Which pretty much should have just sank at that point.
Yeah.
So
I'd argue, David, that this is probably a relatively similar tactic to what China's been doing around the world in terms of, you know, you find politicians and you give them nice consultancies and you negotiate nice deals with them, and you know, and it's worked relatively well in non-developing countries, in developing countries or countries with sort of poor controls, but. You know, I think certainly for you and for others, it was quite a surprise to see them manage to get away with a deal like that in a country like Australia.
It was. But, you know, from there, and we were obviously raising the alarm bells at the time, you know, as loudly as we could. And, you know, in some ways, well, pretty much single-handed. But anyway, then came along came Sam Dastyari, which was the best thing that ever happened to Australia and blew the entire issue sky high. So the media got onto it, and then there was a whole sequence of scandals around Chinese influence, United Front activities in Australia, which is a kind of shadowy soft power influence network promoted by Beijing, where, you know, where it uses relationships, money, and general underhanded tactics to push forward Chinese interests in not even in second track diplomacy terms, just in terms of, like, you know, brown paper bag terms, basically. And it was exposed, and so we had this kind of mushrooming and snowballing of Australian awareness of all these problems, and you know, to my surprise and gratitude, Malcolm Turnbull stood up at that point and just said, "Well, enough is enough. We're going to have to push back against this," and he put I think his his senior international relations advisor, John Garneau, onto a program of writing up a policy document to help push back. And so that process was undertaken, and sadly Turnbull lost his job before it could be deployed. But then after some dithering, the Morrison government has been increasingly deploying that via very similar sort of tactics that it used against terrorism, using a kind of community integrated, well, they call it the counterterrorism. I can't remember. An office in Canberra that coordinates all agencies and all information, and very much integrated with the community, that tries to bring them all together in a way that enables the appropriate authority to respond to any kind of threat. And so since that legislation was pushed through, things have accelerated. We've had, arrests. Some people who were, clearly fronting a lot of CC Bunny get kicked out, had their residency revoked, and other little scandals, just in a steady drip. This brought us to, brings us roughly to where we were, like, before things really started to go downhill into what we have now, which is the trade war, which is, developed in recent months. And, what the rhetoric that we've seen over the last few months, where China has become, they've developed this wolf warrior diplomacy, which is, just basically a nice title for being an angry asshole in your country and trying to push you around and threaten you with various, economic reprisals if you don't do as you're told. That's really developed a lot and has now come through various fits and starts to what we have today, which is essentially a list of 14 demands from Wolf Warrior China for what Australia has to do if it wants to see a normal trading relationship restored. And of course, the 14 demands are preposterous. They're not. There's no way that Canberra can possibly agree to them. They would represent the near collapse of Australian democracy. They would certainly make us a silent, illiberal South Pacific satrap of China, and so we simply can't do it. And that leaves us where we are today, which is at this impasse where China is more or less trialing a new way of bullying smaller powers using economic coercion. It's very deliberate. It's very tactical and strategic. And it is very much a part of this whole Xi Jinping thought. So they're trying it out on Australia first. So far, we've held out. If we succeed in holding out, I think we'll be doing the world a great favour as well as ourselves. But if we don't, then, it will deploy this policy wherever anybody gets in its way. Sorry. Yes. Did we want...
We want to get into the investment side, but it's probably worth just giving, just thinking through some of the other issues. I'm just trying to work out if there's anything we haven't covered off on in that.
There's a lot in that one. Thanks, Dave.
Yeah. I think it's certainly safe to say as well, there's been what would appear to be a constant stream of leaks from security agencies about whether it be hacking or sort of other behavior sort of that's going on in the background that often doesn't have a name in terms of which country's doing it, but it will there's certainly implications in terms of that sort of come from China in terms of those. So that's one side. And the other thing I thought was worth noting as well that, that whole the wolf warrior side as well, it has also, to me, turned into the boy who cried wolf because they were so outraged about sort of more minor things that if you're outraged about every single thing that anyone ever does or anyone talks about, people stop listening to the outrage because when actually something serious happens and you're outraged, it's like, well, I can't tell the difference. Is this a serious issue or is it just a minor issue? You're outraged at everything. So I just don't know which to take. And I think that's sort of another complicating factor, obviously, for the Australian relationship.
Hmm. Yes. perhaps we should run through just quickly the 14 demands, give people an idea of what's being required of us if we want to stay friends. They were leaked to the press this morning. Basically, we have to reverse any protection against foreign investment. We have to reverse the decision that is now global across developed markets to ban Huawei from participating in 5G. That's happened now throughout the US liberal empire, including in Europe. We've got to scrap the foreign interference legislation that I just described, and allow the United Front to do its thing.
Well, basically, as I said, allow anyone, any foreign country to come and involve themselves in our politics. Yes.
Yep. They've got to silence the media and its criticism of China, if there is any. We have to silence any objective on the front of an independent inquiry into COVID. We have to give up wanton interference in Chinese internal matters, such as Hong Kong, Xinjiang or Tibet or anyone else, not that we ever did interfere. We've got to give them the South China Sea. Stop promoting any pro-US view on anything, basically, which is couched as propaganda. Yes, we've got to scrap the scrutiny of subnational government agreements with China, so that Dan Andrews' agreement, Belt and Road Agreement, can go ahead. I'm not sure that that's going to do Dan Andrews any favours, to be honest, but that's a condition. We have to scrap ASPI, which is the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, which is funded about 90% by the Australian Defence Force, and it does have a little bit of funding for specific programs from a few defence manufacturers on the side, just for transparency, but it's run a very effective and very quite transparent kind of safe house for views that have attacked, you know, these various Chinese influence campaigns. So it has to be disbanded. Got to stop kicking out any of these Chinese agents of influence. And, we have to muzzle the Australian Parliament as well. And any Chinese critics in the Australian Parliament have to be silenced. Of course, and the media. So, I mean, as you can see, they are preposterous conditions. They're not conditions we can meet. And so I don't really see this entire gambit now as even an attempt to rectify things. I don't think that they could be so stupid as to think that this will work in terms of delivering the outcome that they want. So to be perfectly honest, I'm not sure what they think they're doing now.
Well, I guess the question for me, David, is it seems to me it's almost a Trumpian negotiating phase. You ask for something so outrageous that when you just ask for something extreme, it seems delicate. If we say,
perhaps, but it's just the CCP is just not famous for negotiating that way and climbing down from positions.
Mm. Yeah.
So, you know, they don't like to appear to climb down on anything. So, you know, at this stage, it's just difficult to see how this ends well in terms of any kind of reconciliation. The thing is, within China itself and within Chinese politics, going back to this notion of Xi Jinping thought, the recent fifth plenum only a few weeks ago, it elevated economics and economic relationships into this pantheon of Xi Jinping thought, that is making them officially tools of strategic CCP security. And so this is now an expression of the new China and what China is. This is no longer a random thing. This is a deliberate policy. And I think they've overreached in a rather large way because, I mean, China, the Australian politics isn't going to buckle to this. The coalition isn't going to buckle. Labor might have because they're much more captured by the entire kind of China as a friendly power propaganda edifice. And so Labor might have, but as we've discussed on these potties before, the Australian people haven't fallen for it. They've gone completely the other way with just absolutely scandalous levels of objection to Chinese influence, and so it's not going to work. And so if you think about it in terms of a deliberate policy and an attempt, you know, as a policy model to be used on other countries, you know, they've picked on Australia, a little country with the largest Chinese economic influence. And if it doesn't work here, they're going to look pretty bloody stupid.
The flip side, though, is that it's an example. Like they're basically saying to other countries, look what we'll do to Australia, and try and freeze Australia out of everything they can, with a view that they can then scare some of the smaller countries into line.
Yes. Well, I don't, and that's part of, you know, this whole notion of Xi Jinping thought as, and this being in a formal policy, certainly. At that point, it becomes both scary, because if that is now the goal, then they have to keep going ever deeper into this to make sure that there's some pain. But the other part of it is they actually don't have the levers that they think they do over Australia. So this is quite a good jumping off point for us to get into the impacts on the economy and markets. Because, you know, their biggest lever by far is commodities, and you know, the huge lever within that is iron ore. In effect, they need the iron ore a hell of a lot more than we need to sell it. So they can't really bring much of this pressure to bear on the one point where it might actually be quite sensitive, because, you know, in the array of commodities that have been blocked, iron ore is the one that if you could displace it, it would be difficult to find an alternative market, because China consumes so much of it. But you know, that's the same reason that they can't do it, because they're so dependent on the Australian source. So iron ore is off the table in the short term, as we've discussed before. It'll probably get hit long term through, you know, funding.
And iron ore is not far off half the total exports of Australia to China.
Yes, that's right. So iron ore was always going to get hit anyway. So at the end of the day, it's not really going to matter that much in the long run. The other commodities will just go to other markets because, you know, they're fungible. And as China shifts its demand to other suppliers, they'll have to take their supply from other markets, and we can move in there. And so it's not a huge deal for the commodities that Australia exports.
For a lot of commodities,
not all. It's just not a deal breaker. And if you look at the ones they've all targeted, you know, especially the ags, you know, it actually, you know, you only report the negative, right? If you look at things like barley and nearly all of the softs, in fact, they've all boomed in the last kind of 18, 24 months into China. And so it was like during during the US trade war with China, that China was trying to bribe us away from the US. And so that's just simply been reversed. And so we're only losing 18 months of growth here. It's not the end of the world. It's not the end of the world.
Yeah, and also with most of these, as we've discussed, you know, if you don't sell your barley, there's only a fixed certain amount of barley that's grown in the world. If it's Australia's not selling its barley to China, then the barley's coming from Canada or South America, and then ours is going to, you know, Europe instead of the Canadian ones or whatever it is.
Quite right.
Or similar with copper is a very similar one. The one of the ones on the list, the coal, though, that's one of the ones where it is coal's very cheap per ton. Anything that's so copper is in thousands of dollars. You sell for thousands of dollars per ton. Coal is usually sub $100 per ton. And so when the transport cost might be $50-$60 to send it to Europe, then all of a sudden it's a big deal. Coal is something that's just far better off to be dug up very, very close to where you're doing it.
Yes. So, there's a couple of points on that front. Before we got to this impasse, we were already getting blocked on coal. Everybody was, because China had turned to internal sources, presumably to protect local interests. That was long before the tensions rose, so not such a big deal. There will be damage for coking coal. That's thermal coal I was talking about. There's more damage for coking coal, yep. But, you know, all those coals are going to be under pressure long term anyway from climate change, so I can accept that as well. The big one for me is yet is an odd one because it's yet to land and it has landed, and that is students and tourism. And they have landed because of COVID.
We haven't noticed yet.
But we haven't noticed because obviously we're in the entire sort of COVID stimulus phase.
And everything's down. Like everyone's going, oh, yeah, okay, tourism's down for everyone, and it's down for everyone. When it does start flying back is when you'll actually notice, oh, the Chinese tourism isn't coming back and the Chinese students aren't coming back.
Yeah. That's right. So that's a story of weaker recovery than you would have had otherwise. And that may have some implications. I think it will have some implications for things like Aussie property with, you know, a lot less Chinese interest and money, not necessarily resulting in falling prices, but, you know, maybe going up less and holding down in particular Melbourne and Sydney, as well as a lot of oversupply, you know, in commercial as well as residential property in those cities for quite a while. But even on that front, if you know, that proves to be a, you know, an economic adjustment of macroeconomic scale, that is, the damage is enough that it causes you to, you know, lose enough jobs that it's, you know, real economic pain, then, you know, the end result of that is more easing and a lower Australian dollar. And so you can recapture those students from other markets again over time. It may take a couple of years, but if the economic weakness resulting from it is real, then you become more competitive. This is why people float their currencies, and you can capture market share elsewhere, both in terms of tourism and students. And there's no doubt that both tourism and students are extremely AUD sensitive. So, you know, even on that front, it's a short-term adjustment. So you might have a little bit of pain, but long-term it won't matter. So where do we go from here?
Actually, one other thing I wanted to bring up, which is on the next slide, Tim's going to show as well, is so there's this bit. There's been this RCEP trade deal, that just launched, and so China, Indonesia, Japan, South Korea, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand, you know, and basically all the Asian countries, pretty much are in there, except for India hasn't jumped in, but
India was supposed to go in, but it bailed.
And I don't know if you can see this one, David. I've listed all the trade surplus countries on one side and all the trade deficit countries on the other side.
Yeah.
And there's a much longer list of trade surplus countries than there is of trade deficit countries. So there's one argument going, okay, we've just struck this big trade deal right across Asia, and that'll sort us all out. And I guess what I'm saying is, in the world, there tends to be countries that are very focused on increasing their exports and sort of protecting their markets and really pushing this whole trade surplus. And then there's countries that don't really care, and they make up the trade deficit countries. And we're one of the trade deficit countries, and we've just struck a deal with all the trade surplus countries. So it's not like we've opened up these massive markets for all our products to flow into.
No, and when you look at it, it's a pretty funny deal in terms of who's going to be outsourcing their production to this enormous swathe of Asian mercantilists. But like the RCEP or RCEP, whatever it is, it's not a China-led thing. People shouldn't think that. It was really born out of ASEAN, and China jumped in. So it's not a China, a regional trade agreement led by China, even though China's in it. It's clearly not going to be any great answer. I mean, in policy,
part of China is like China signing this, you know, on they're signing this at a document, whatever, yesterday or the day before, whatever, at the same time as they're launching all this stuff with Australia, who they've already got a free trade deal with.
Yeah,
and all the economic pain they're gonna inflict upon Australia. So, you know, if you're a country signing this deal, it's not like you say, well, yeah, now that we've got a free trade deal, I can just let Yeah, I can really let things rip with China, because you can see as they're literally as the ink hasn't even dried on the paper, you can see what they're doing to countries they have free trade deals with already.
Well, and it's interesting this outcome, because there's not a single country in that RCEP that would look at what China's doing to Australia and be happy about it. like it's, how this will probably end is Australia just slowly creates a coalition of conscientious objectors to Chinese behaviour. You're already starting to see hints of that around the margins, as far away as Germany. Germany's sending destroyers down into the South China Sea now to give us some moral support. But all these other countries who are in the RCEP must be wondering what the hell they've done, signing up with China. And what is China's word worth? Because it doesn't look like much. We've got as comprehensive arrangement of trade deals as you can have with China, and it hasn't protected us a damn. So I would expect that, kind of a slow kind of multilateral response to kind of save China, I think, in that, to sort of ride to Australia's support through this, especially when the Biden administration takes over. I would think there'll be some rallying support for Australia, and perhaps that's the way the thing finally settles down, is it just disappears into a multilateral fog and is de-escalated that way, rather than being this bilateral tit for tat. And so there's no real resolution reached, but perhaps, the hostilities just calm down and as it disappears into a more generalised discussion. I don't know. But, I mean, it seems to me I didn't quite finish the last bit, I guess, which was, if this is a deliberate Chinese strategy and they don't really have the leverage that they're behaving like they do, then if they can't find a way of just kicking this into the long grass where it can just sit there and disappear, then they have to just keep doubling down. And I just don't know where that goes. I mean, the thing is, it's doing them harm as well. It's quite internecine, this. It means that they've got to buy more expensive goods from elsewhere, quite possibly inferior goods and higher prices. They are a massive trade-dependent commodity importer. And do they really want to screw up those open markets that have enabled them to develop at such a fast pace? I mean, that's staggeringly short-sighted if they were to actually drive this to a point where they would jeopardise something like iron ore.
Well, and it's also the part that, last year was the year, or the year before maybe, was the year of, the tariffs and escalating tariffs in China and US companies really being urged to look at their supply chains and to diversify away. None of this behavior is going to give you, if you're a US supplier thinking, oh, well, maybe with Biden I can leave my China stuff there for a bit longer. And then you see what's happening with Australia, China is actually going, well, okay, that's not a case. I do need to, I do need to continue that decoupling from and diversifying my supply chain. The sort of robotic, looking to how can I use robotics and automation and all these other things to do things that could have been done in China at home.
Mm. Yeah, I would think that will keep going on under the surface. And that's I guess another outcome, isn't it? Where we're rolling from the Trump trade wars, which were exactly as you described, a real push to get some of those supply chains back from China. And into COVID, which has shocked the life out of everybody and really, really destroyed China's reputation worldwide.
And disrupted supply chains as well. Like, one more thing to say, I want to have all my production in a country thousands of kilometres away?
Yeah, and then this, incredibly hawkish turn in wolf warrior kind of diplomacy everywhere. It's not just Australia. It's everywhere. It's been particularly focused on Australia, but you know they haven't yet threatened Australian expatriates in Hong Kong like they have to Canada. Canada. So I mean, there are you know further deteriorations to go in that in those terms.
Yeah. Well, it's probably worth bringing up though, isn't it, David? That you know the Canadian. So they're obviously China's doing a very similar thing to Canada. Well, sorry, not a very similar thing. They've started down the path in terms of Canada in terms of saying, yeah, by arresting one of our citizens, you know, we will now hold hostage
300,000 of yours.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
As you say, like it's cry wolf. I mean, the CCP has an extraordinary glass jaw, which presumably, I guess all kind of dictatorial regimes do because they can't broker any form of opposition lest it spread. But the CCP is remarkably glass jawed on any kind of criticism. Anyway, we've rolled now into this incredible kind of trade smash with Australia. So, I mean, what I'm building up to is back to your point, which is, you know, China's reputation for trade and investment and supply chains is going from bad to worse. You know, it keeps putting the boot in wherever it can, and I just would therefore expect global decoupling to continue because, you know, the risk I haven't even mentioned Hong Kong and the Hong Kong takeover. So, you know, there are many, many reasons to pull your supply chains out of China right now. And they seem to be getting worse, not better. So in the long run, you know, as we get into global recovery post-COVID, this is probably more likely to start to bite. You know, so far, Chinese exports have actually boomed in recent times. But I think that's really a function of the Western stimulus packages and the fact that, you know, China's own stimulus was very much supply side focused. And so, you know, it's enjoying the global inventory cycle, which has been triggered by COVID shutdowns and recovery. So I don't think that's going to last. And they will find themselves back into manufacturing recession, which they've been in more or less for the last 3 or 4 years.
Just on that, Dave, we've had a question drop in. Will Vietnam take a large share of global production away from China?
Well, it'll take a lot of production, yes.
Yep. I mean, it's too small to take a to make much of a difference to China. In terms of Vietnam's own economy, yes, it helps, but in terms of not enough
people. Vietnam, Southeast Asia, Thailand, probably in particular, and Mexico.
But the other thing as well is
Eastern Europe.
Yeah, but robotics is the other thing, and automation. Robotics, the cost of robots and the amount they can do has come down dramatically over the last 10, 15 years. And so if you're moving your supply chain from quite a manual process, yes, you'll definitely go with another Asian country that we can get cheap labor. But in terms of finding, if you can look at it and say, well, yes, it's actually almost as cheap to run it with robots as what it is to run that, and you can see the trend, and you're going, well, that's only going to get cheaper. Then it's a good reason to pull it back and put it closer to the, it's far better to have your supply chain, much closer and roboticized, so you don't have to worry about, things like coronavirus and all that disrupting your supply chain. And than others, and also 3D printing as well is another one. Like, there's a lot of things also pushing the same direction that saying that the old model of mass producing in one big factory, you know, something for the entire world, is steadily out the door. For any listeners who didn't listen in, we had David Morgan on not that long ago talking about what they're doing and how they produce a lot of steel products to build houses and solar powered houses, and about how basically in terms of scale they've just built their factories to be quite small and quite modular and it's all run by the robots, and the robots cost $5,000 a pop, so it's not huge amounts of capital, and rather than trying to centralize everything and have one big factory, they're much happier to have factories spread around the country. So and I think that's a microcosm of what we expect in a lot of different industries.
Yeah.
Just one more, actually. Just while we're on the question front here, there was one here. Will China allow capital to return to China similar to the Trump repatriation tax benefits? So that might be quite a good one.
Allow? Allows the key word in that one. I think there's a lot of people in China who have made a lot of money, and given, you know, some of the stuff David was talking about before, corruption, crackdowns, you know, and stuff like that, they would like to have their money somewhere else.
Somewhere else, yeah, I was going to say.
And so when you say allow money to come back, it's actually, yeah. It's quite restrictive in terms of getting money out of China is quite restrictive. But doubly so if you're a Chinese citizen, or more than doubly so, you know, 10 times harder if you're a Chinese citizen than if you're a foreign national. It's hard. It's a little bit difficult if you're a foreign national trying to get your money out of China. If you're a Chinese person, it's way, way, way harder. Mm. So they're very keen to keep capital. They're very keen to attract capital, foreign capital, and give the illusion that you can bring it in and out. But I think if they need capital, if the proverbial hits the fan, they've got capital controls and they know how to use them. So you couldn't guarantee, you know, this sort of you just might find you can't get your capital out for a few years.
Mm. Absolutely, which is one reason why I just wonder why so many high profile fund managers are so keen to put their capital in there. You know, even down to the recent smash of Chinese tech. You know, and the suspension of Ant and the IPO, and you know, like this happens every 2 or 3 years in China. Suddenly, the CCP just gets spooked that someone's getting too powerful. They flick a switch, and the capital just disappears.
Snuff them out.
Yeah, and so, like, why do you want to put your money in there? I mean, I know it's growing, but you just might not get it back.
Hmm.
You know, look. Anyway, so perhaps we should run through just a little more explicitly, you know, the various asset markets and what this discussion, how it bears upon them, just quickly, because I'm sure people are interested in property and the Aussie dollar, for instance. So property, as I mentioned, you know, I don't think that this is a sort of crash scenario necessarily. It just weighs at the margin. So. Whatever's happening, if prices are going up, they won't be going up as much. Certainly in Sydney and Melbourne, this is a negative, so that probably helps push them out of any positive real estate price cycle that's forthcoming, which has more or less been our outlook now for a month or so, where non-Southeast capitals, basically the non-virus capitals, will probably do quite well, but Sydney and Melbourne will lag. Longer term, I do think that it will, you know, hurt property. Not so much the decoupling from China. There's just simply the fact that we won't be developing with it anymore. And, you know, iron ore will inevitably decline over time, as it was always going to anyway. And so that will pose some income challenges for Australia over time.
And definitely fewer students. I think. I mean, you spoke about attracting students from elsewhere, but I think there's to me there's nowhere really that you can get enough income, a large enough middle class, or even sort of upper middle class, I guess, that can afford to send their kids to a foreign country, and also want to and quite expensive, you know, but also you know. Have the desire not to have it locally, because you'd say, oh, we could attract all these students from America, and it's like, well, no, most American students just want to go to American schools. It's not like there's a real need. You need to find these developing countries, and so maybe there's something in India, but you don't quite have the same dynamics there.
No, and they don't tend to buy the property when they get here. So in terms of property, I think China's between 20% and 25% of students overall, but they're definitely the rich ones. So they're much higher impact at the margin in terms of consumption, and definitely property construction, as well as existing property, but certainly property construction units in inner city apartments and what have you, where we've got this enormous glut in Melbourne. It's Melbourne City is basically a ghost city now, Chinese-style ghost city. And that looks set to persist for a few years as post-COVID authorities will certainly try and switch immigration back on, but it won't be able to come in at the same furious pace. So it will take time to backfill all of that. And that's one of the reasons Sydney and Melbourne will struggle relative to other capitals. The other big one, I guess, is the Australian dollar. At the moment, the Aussie dollar is more or less ignoring all domestic data. It's really just operating as a negative cipher of the US dollar. As markets, obsess over the post-COVID environment with vaccines and presidential elections and Wall Street extraordinary valuations, etc. And typically, if we are into a new cycle, a new business cycle, which is questionable, there's some sort of stimulus-led, mini cycle at least underway. Typically, what happens is where these things are birthed is the US dollar falls, and that helps, reflate the rest of the world through commodity prices rising and capital running into emerging markets. And that's an environment where the Australian dollar always rises. So for a little while, the Aussie dollar can ignore these issues of Chinese divorce. But when the world starts to settle back into whatever cycle is coming our way, which will probably be inhibited by the amount of debt we've taken on to fight COVID and by the simple fact that things you're already seeing, like in the US, where fiscal policy is already being wound back, as we haven't made the full move to a kind of MMT world, and so we'll the pendulum will swing a little bit back towards austerity and then growth will sputter. Once we get to that stage of the cycle sometime next year, then the fact that the Australian economy will be lagging the global recovery, in part because of the decoupling from China, is likely to weigh pretty heavily on the Aussie dollar, I think. So I do expect the Aussie dollar to rise for the time being, but nothing like we saw post GFC, and I think it will flame out relatively quickly in the scheme of these things and start to fall again. So I think it will come to bear on the Aussie dollar before too long. And then probably the other big one is yields, interest rates in Australia and the RBA. Obviously it mitigates against any kind of tightening from the RBA because it there will be some adjustment to all these things that will weigh on domestic demand for a little while, and they'll hurt any income recovery. That said, if we do manage to get through to some kind of global recovery and Australia doesn't flood itself with immigration and international students again, then we could actually see a little bit of wage growth here before too long, maybe in a couple of years, and that might help domestic demand a little. But net, the Chinese decoupling will again keep rates lower for longer here. So that's a story for support in real estate bonds and for a lower Aussie dollar over time as the cycle develops.
Just on that, Dave, before we hand it over to Damien, I've got a question here, sorry. How does gold and gold miners fit into the AUD outlook?
I think it's pretty good. I mean, right now, gold is struggling a bit. And perhaps in part because of the bizarro rise of Bitcoin. It's hard to know. I can't really grasp how mature fund managers would be going to Bitcoin as a safe haven versus a devaluing US dollar, but perhaps they are somewhat. But then gold ran very hard earlier in the year, so this is just probably a consolidation phase. The primary input for me into gold, the value of gold, is the US dollar, and given I see it falling, then I think it's still a bullish argument for gold. And then, if this plays out in the way I'm seeing, which is we get that lower US dollar for a while and that boosts gold, and then we roll into a new phase of Australian dollar weakness, which isn't necessarily going to be US dollar strength. Like if the US dollar stays low and gold stays high, then that's a pretty positive outlook Australian gold miners in particular, because you will have the, you know, the obviously the rising price of the commodity, and then the falling price of the Aussie dollar as well in a second phase. So yeah, I'm pretty constructive still on Aussie gold miners. They've been correcting now very solidly for a few months.
So we sort of halved our weight in gold miners a few months ago.
Yeah.
And then at some stage we'll look to try and maybe scale that back up again.
Yeah. Well, they are looking more and more like, you know, I mean, some of them are still very expensive, but there is a lot more value there than there was several months ago. So, yeah, it's still relatively constructive on gold, yes, especially Aussie gold.
Okay. I've just jumped across to the investment outlook slide here.
So, I mean, while we're talking stocks as well, that's fine. Yeah, you can throw that up. That's actually a broader term. So just in terms of just some of the stuff David was talking about. So, you know, there's certainly stocks in there that are positive and negative from these factors we're talking about. So, we look upon things like, say, a Treasury Wines as saying, okay, we think they're selling wine. A lot of it was to China, but wine's a bit of a global market. If it doesn't sell in, you know, if China brings in more exports from Europe or from America or South America, you know, that there's other markets that Australian wine could be sold into. So there's certainly some short term negatives, but we do think there's a little bit of, we've sort of been trying to take advantage of those types of falls.
Yep.
For something like an A2 milk, we think it's probably a little bit it's a different story though for something like that, in that you've got this huge demand from China, and it's not obvious where the next market's going to be if it's not China. So if China decides that it's not going to be bringing in all this milk from Australia and baby formula and those types of things, you know, it's not like there's another market sitting out there that's all of a sudden going to become the primary driver for it. So, you know, there might be other. I guess it's a little bit stock by stock, but I guess as a broader overview, we're trying to sort of map stocks into ones which we think will probably do all right anyway. And you might be able to use some weakness to pick some up versus ones where you just want to be a little bit more cautious before jumping in. And then we've been on this supply chain bit for a long time now, just sort of looking for companies that sort of fit within that. So we've got a range of different companies that have some exposure to this. And this is this theme that you know, if supply chains are moving, then companies that are helping supply chains move will benefit. The unfortunate thing is robotics is getting really cheap, and so it's actually not as much of a gain. And some of the best robotics stocks actually are also pretty heavily involved in the energy sector. And regardless of what your view is on the energy price itself, it's certainly clear that exploration is down a long way, and sort of new spending in that area is not particularly high. So just finding stocks that give you the upside of the robotic stuff you're looking for without the downside of a big energy sector exposure is more difficult in that area. So okay. Yeah, so that's some of the themes. And then this overall, actually, sorry, Dave, did you have anything else on the stock side that you wanted to, just in terms of country exposures that I've missed?
No, that covers us, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, and then I've just got a long list here of, you know, just as a broader overview of where we are is you know, you've got some sort of key positive factors, and there's a long list of them, and then there's a long list of these negative factors, and it really is a bit of a clash at the moment in terms of, you know, both those coming to a head, and there's some very short term ones that are negative in terms of the virus and you know, really exploding in the Northern Hemisphere and lockdowns, but a lot of those other negative ones are a little bit longer term, or they're the ones that seem like they're just going to keep getting kicked. The can's going to keep getting kicked down the road by governments. So the danger is they stop. So we've got things like sort of latent bankruptcies. Bankruptcies are sort of down. Personal bankruptcies are sort of down 30-40% sort of globally. And it's not because we think this has been a fantastic period and people aren't going bankrupt anymore. It's because, you know, government stimulus and rules around bankruptcies have been changed. So so there's these latent bankruptcies that need to eventually be resolved. They've got this low credit growth, and a lot of the credit growth you are getting is credit growth because people companies are refinancing or they're borrowing because they can't afford to pay their expenses, which is not the credit growth you want. You want credit growth because they're investing in new projects. And anyway, so you can go through a lot of those other the negative ones and see that they're all ones that are just that little bit longer out. And so So I guess it's this view about, is there a little bit of clear air at some stage? If once you pass through some of the really short term issues, and they're the factors we're weighing up. And obviously, you know, markets are extremely overvalued based on the earnings. But if it's a matter of just saying, well, ignoring the earnings for two, three, 4 years until it eventually comes good, anyway.
And there's something in it, as you mentioned before, in regards to, you know, peeling back the layers and really, and this is obviously where that stock analysis piece is crucial in finding those sort of fungible suppliers that, you know, as you mentioned with Treasury Wines, I think it's a great example where you've got the ability to, they'll have a short-term hit, but, you know, Australian wine's one of the best quality in the world and it's going to move around the world eventually anyway, and demand will hopefully soak it up versus the one-horse pony sort of risk that you've got when you're sort of weighing up, you know, what deserves a place in our portfolios.
Yeah, and there's just sort of, you know, obviously there's lots of different stock issues that every stock has, and you know, you do need to be looking at in detail at all the factors. But I guess what I'm getting to is there's some broader themes, but still within those broader themes, you still need to dig into the actual stocks and see where the real exposures are.
Yep, very good. A couple of questions here, actually. Just one, actually, just here. Are Australian banks undercapitalised? Thanks, Paul.
They're unquestionably strong, aren't they, according to the APRA and the best in the world? Isn't that Dave?
It's how long is a piece of string? I don't think they're undercapitalised if you accept, you know, normal business parameters. Mm-hmm. But if you are talking about a major shock, then yes, they're severely undercapitalised. So it's one of those things where you know, it depends what model you deploy, and if you're relying on the last sort of 30 years where there hasn't been a major shock, then they're incredibly strong and well capitalised. If you look over the long cycle, we have larger accidents transpire from time to time and more serious deleveraging, then they're seriously undercapitalized. So it's both is the answer.
Yeah, and I guess there's and keep in mind that the we've been looking at these cycles in terms of these debt cycles, and they sort of go through these periods where short-term and long-term debt cycles is the Ray Dalio tense, which we quite like as a model for it, where, you know, short-term business cycles over sort of 3 to 7 years, and then you've got this big longer-term debt cycle that keeps coming out. And so this sort of short-term debt cycles we thought was peaking out and would fall, but so many things have been put in place now that make it look as if this debt cycle isn't going to roll over at this stage. You've got governments and everyone trying to force as much credit down everyone's throat as they can. Is it maybe there's another leg up to this whole credit cycle? And so banks get to bask in the sunlight for just a little bit longer before it starts raining.
Just on that, actually, another question here: what should the government do, if anything, to support exporters caught in the crossfire? And is it doing enough?
I think it's doing the right thing in terms of just telling them to diversify, and it should be doing as much as it can to make that possible, you know, where there are policy inhibitors, so they can run around and do some more trade deals and what have you. But I think should they be bailing anyone out? Probably not. I mean, you know, we always knew what China was, didn't we? You know, I mean, anyone, and it's not as if we always knew what China was in the long term scheme of things, and in the shorter term, we've known very explicitly since Donald Trump was elected that this was a relationship that was in pretty serious trouble in terms of China and the Anglosphere. And so anybody who wasn't paying attention to that wasn't paying attention to the market. And I don't see why the taxpayer should necessarily bail that out. And the adjustment process will be one of finding new markets, and that will require falling prices for a little while, and you want that to transpire as well. So they can do what they can do at the policy level, but for the most part, just let the market take care of it, I think.
Mm-hmm. A couple of last ones as well, just in the interest of time. So we've got a one here. What options are there to invest cash in other than the ASX, fellas?
Oh, well, I mean, there's all sorts of funds at MB, for starters.
Not a Dorothy Dixer, I promise you. Thank you, Ruby.
There's a few obvious winners. I think Brisbane Property, not that you'll ever catch me recommending property, but I mean, if I was oriented towards fixed assets at the moment, I would certainly be looking at Brisbane Property. The ASX is an interesting one. It's certainly
Having said that, though, David, like there's part of that's the fact that renting is actually the buying versus renting stacks up pretty well in Brisbane versus elsewhere.
It does, and the yields are reasonable there.
Yeah, so. but if you're going to say, would you like, we're going into a period of volatility, how would you like to pay a lot of stamp duty right now up front and go into a period of where you hold an extremely illiquid asset that's going to take you months to sell if you decide to change your mind? That's the part where we'd be saying that's a...
Like, sure. As I said, I wouldn't be recommending property, but if you put a gun to my head and said, where should I put my money in property, I'd say Brisbane. The Australian stock market's a really interesting question because our profits outlook sucks, like really bad. And we've recovered really poorly from COVID, which is strange given we were so good on the virus. But our profit outlook is worse than just about everywhere, although that is going to change in the short term with the renewed outbreaks in the Northern Hemisphere, but that will pass.
But it's not because our profit outlook's getting better.
Those are coming back to ours is all. Right. And ours will remain crap. And as iron ore comes off next year, it'll get worse and worse because it's such a big driver of Australian profit growth or shrinkage. But at the same time, QE has put a rocket under the ASX, and in particular the banks, through this value rotation, which is basically what happens when you start to see, long-end bond yields rise a bit, and that starts to get markets thinking in terms of cyclical investments, which tend to be more value-based. You buy them when they're cheap, and that's the banks, the Aussie banks. And so they've run very hard and really lifted the ASX in recent, probably in the last month or so. Our outlook on that is pretty bleak as well, because we think the Aussie banks are effectively going the way of Japan or Europe, which is, it's the structural decline of their profitability. And we've run out of lower cash rates to artificially boost the appeal of the yields of the banks. But we've kind of got one last party going on that front. So when you look at...
The other thing with the banks as well is you're basically going to be government supported. Or more RBA supported. And so we've floated the uncomfortable thought from our perspective is, and actually just to put this in perspective, a European bank at the moment, if it makes a home loan to somebody, so it makes a home loan to David, David comes and pays about 0.5% in interest on his mortgage. And then the European Central Bank turns around and doubles whatever David paid in interest and gives that to the bank. Basically they're you got 0.5% interest that David's paying, and the ECB is paying -1%, or paying the banks 1% for the so effectively they're paying them they're trying to keep them profitable. They're trying to make sure the banks don't fall over, and so
which they can do. It's just you're just not going to get any real growth out of it. So.
Yeah, But it's also the part you're almost, you're basically at the mercy of what regulators think you should earn as a profit. So maybe all those lunches and, you know, cricket tickets to the cricket and all that type of stuff have paid off, and maybe we'll be more generous than overseas in terms of keeping the banks profitable.
Yeah,
I hope.
So all of those factors amount to a very expensive ASX. I mean, we're almost as expensive as the US, only a little bit behind it. And so if you were looking at stocks, I really think that you're better off utilizing, you know, what is for the time being a rising Australian dollar to buy international stocks, where you'll find much better growth outlooks. And you'll be set then for what comes after, which I think is a relatively quickly rollover in the Aussie dollar, as our structural problem with profits and growth comes to bear as the rest of the world recovers.
Very good. Not so much a question here, but maybe a finishing thought. It's a pity that our grandkids will suffer from the Dutch disease established in this era. The reliance on iron ore and gas will make us a dull and flaccid economy.
Well, that's where we've been. I'm not sure that's where we're going to go. You know, the great upside in Chinese decoupling, which is a point I keep making on the blog, it's the best thing to happen in 20 years, is that those forces will have to reverse. Now, as Damo's pointed out, some of that's going to happen through robotics and manufacturing getting cheaper. I don't think Australia is about to suddenly boom in terms of being able to make stuff. I think we've become a very dumb manufacturing economy. What's left is very dumb, and it's going to take a long time.
I'd push back a little bit. I think there's certain elements of it that's dumb, but I think we do some very – it's either dumb or very, very smart.
I'd say smart enough to survive. Yeah, big is dumb. I'll put it that way. Yeah. I think the guys you talk to are much more niche, and that's probably where the future is. But repatriation of that kind of production will be a key feature of the next cycle. So that's terrific. And so we're probably past the nadir of our double Dutch disease. But it took us, 30 years to get here. So it'll probably take 30 years to rebuild. But I don't think it'll get worse from here. I mean, there's not much more we can throw into the sea, to be honest. Well,
and it is worth noting, you know, China, which is using so much of the world's commodities, is seriously looking at whether it needs a growth model, you know, what it can do in terms of growth model, and whether it can start growing its services industry rather than just building more buildings to nowhere.
Yes.
If it's doing that, then and you know, stops just knocking buildings down and putting them back up again, that'll reduce demand for commodities globally and sort of wean Australia off that and hopefully onto something else.
Yeah, that's right. It just won't be Chinese services.
Yes, that's right.
Very good. All right, gents. Well, look, if there's nothing further, we might tie it up there for the day. We've gone run a little bit over time here. It's been a very full and very interesting discussion, mate. Very in depth. So thank you to you both for coming along and sharing your thoughts.
No worries.
Thanks, Damien. Thanks. Oh, good.
Yeah, thanks.
No worries. Just in response as well to Ruby there, and we don't like to openly plug what we do on the show, but there is always the opportunity to check out what we do at nucleuswealth.com. Ruby and any other people that are looking for investments other than the ASX and perhaps Brisbane property. Thank you, David. The viewer question of the week. So feel free to drop in the chat here. Popped up. How far do you think that this recent spat will go? Is it the end or can it be repaired? Your thoughts. Be fantastic to hear what you think, and obviously give us an opportunity to read through those and perhaps get some ideas for the next one on what is probably going to be a series of shows and an enduring theme here for us as well. Coming up next week, and apologies for those that were expecting him this week. We did have to postpone due to the Adelaide lockdown for a change. It's nice not to say Melbourne lockdown anyway. So next week, of course, we've got Dr. Stephen Hale. Stephen holds a PhD in economics and is a lecturer in the topic at the University of Adelaide, where he uses modern monetary frame to understand macroeconomic issues. Following the same monetary expansion theme as today, I'll get it out eventually, we are chatting with Stephen to get his thoughts on the extent to where central banks are supporting weak economies ends and modern monetary theory begins. And it feels like we might be there now. So tune in next week, Thursday, the 26th of November at 12:30 p.m. for a live chat with Dr. Hale. And of course, head to our YouTube channel, Nucleus Investment Insights, to ask questions along the way. So thanks again to all of those who have watched in live today for another great episode. And of course, to those who've asked some terrific questions today as well. And we hope you've taken away some great ideas. And if you'd like to see more of our content, head on over to nucleuswealth.com/content. To stay up to date with news from us, follow us on social media. And finally, if you know anyone who gets something out of today's episode, let them know about it, share with a friend, and help our show grow. So thanks again for tuning in from myself, Tim Fuller, and the team. And we look forward to catching you at the next one.